Future-proof extra.
With Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
On News Talk.
Now, it's almost exactly 4 years since the COVID-19 pandemic came to these shores. And although, thankfully, the pandemic is over, there's still a lot to learn about the disease and its after effects. Long COVID is particularly perplexing, but Irish scientists from the Future Neuro Centre may have shed some light on one aspect of it, brain fog. So what exactly is brain fog and how does a COVID infection bring it about? Well, joining us now is Dr. Matthew Campbell. He's a professor in Trinity School of Genetics and Microbiology and he's a principal investigator at the Future Neuro Centre. He joins me now. Welcome to the programme, Matt. Why were you interested in long COVID and how much of a thing is long COVID? Like, have we determined that long COVID is a genuine and real condition that people have?
Yeah, so first of all, thanks for having me on your show, Jonathan. Really appreciate it. And yeah, I mean, how do we come up, you know, to start investigating long COVID? Well, historically, I'll take you back to March or April 2020 when the pandemic started. And around that time, Science Foundation Ireland issued like a call to arms for, you know, funding to try to explore the societal need that we needed at that moment in time to address COVID-19 pandemic, but also medical and basic research needs. You know, how could we better understand this condition? And myself and my colleague, Colin Doherty, who's a neurologist in St. James's Hospital, we sat down one day and we said, look, are there any neurological symptoms associated with COVID? And Colin at the time was seeing very, very little acutely in the hospitals in St. James's Hospital. People who were turning up with COVID, I mean, it's a respiratory condition. They didn't really have any neurological symptom except for anosmia. So you'll remember that people were losing their sense of smell, especially during the first wave. And that's a neurological symptom because it affects the olfactory bulb at the front of your brain. And we came up with this idea, this hypothesis that maybe the patients who are turning up in hospitals, the ones who are more severe, are they the ones who are developing anosmia? So could anosmia be this sign that we need to keep an eye on these people and get them into hospital? And so, you know, like all of these hypotheses, we were completely wrong and we disproved ourselves that there was no association at all between anosmia and those ended up in hospital. But around May or June, when we started to get these initial data sets, we started to hear about this condition called long COVID. And it was a patient-reported symptom. So it wasn't the doctors weren't making this condition up. It was patients were coming along saying, you know, I had COVID. I think that I should feel better by now, but I still am symptomatic. And the patient groups coined this term long COVID. And that's where our interest came. And we discovered that in a subset of patients who had long COVID, it turned out they had a neurological symptom. And that symptom was, again, a self-reported symptom called brain fog. And that's how myself and Colin really got interested in long COVID, because there was a need. Patients were reporting that they had brain fog associated with long COVID, and they couldn't shake it. They couldn't get out of this concept of they had slowed down thinking. Some of them had cognitive decline. They were having difficulty with short-term memories. They were reporting things, you know, as simple as going out for a drive and forgetting where they were driving to. You know, so these were real. So your initial, you know, question as well of, you know, how do we come up to exploring long COVID and getting interested in it? But also, is it a real thing? It absolutely is a real thing. It really is a real thing. So, you know, I don't think there's any suggestion that it's just in patients' minds. There definitely is something real and biological happening to these patients who can't seem to shake the symptoms.
And just to be clear, because I'm sure some people will be thinking or asking this question to themselves, these patients who were reporting brain fog, this is pre-vaccines for them. So it wasn't a symptom of a vaccine by any chance. That's not possible.
Exactly. So our study only had participants pre-vaccine. So it was basically started recruiting in the middle of 2020. So no vaccines around. It was the original variant or the original strain of the SARS-CoV-2 virus as well. So can we speak to brain fog and vaccines? Absolutely not. No association at all between our study and any vaccines.
Perfect. Okay. So this cohort that you recruited, obviously you need a control group. Tell me a little bit about what you did to try and figure out what was going on and what measurable changes you saw in the brain, if any, because obviously self-reporting has its pitfalls. Obviously patients know their own bodies, as we often hear doctors saying, but what sort of changes did you see when you started to examine this a little bit closer?
Yeah, so there's two major arms to our study. The first part was where we looked at acute COVID-19. So amazingly, you know, it's kind of incredible when you think back to it, that the panic of the pandemic, you know, and people didn't know what they were doing with their jobs and what you know, the direction the country was going to take. But clinicians in St. James's Hospital were actively coming up with ideas of how can we actually, you know, start collecting patient samples and do science for the future, you know, so to bank samples. And so led by Niall Connell and Cleanan Ekialig, two consultants in St. James's Hospital, they started to collect blood samples from patients who were presented to St. James's Hospital, literally as early as March 2020, the very first patients. And we were able to access those samples. Absolutely incredible. We got access to 76 samples that had been collected of patients who were hospitalized with acute COVID-19. The patients were segregated into what we term mild symptoms. So they felt bad enough that they needed to go to hospital. But we classed them as mild because they didn't need supplemental oxygen and they didn't need any further assistance. We then had moderate patients, who were those patients who needed supplemental oxygen, but they didn't need any ICU support. They didn't need any intensive care. And then we had patients who had to go into intensive care. So they're very, very severe respiratory infection. And what we were able to do basically was we were able to screen for a marker of blood vessel damage in the brain. So there are some proteins that are only present in your brain because that's where they function. They don't need to be in the blood. And if there's any damage to the fine capillary network, the small blood vessels in your brain, any damage at all from brain trauma, from a stroke, or from brain fog associated with COVID-19, the vessels will get damaged to a certain point that the protein will move from the brain and we can detect it in the blood. So it's called a biomarker. And we discovered that patients during the acute phase of having COVID-19, who self-reported brain fog, had elevated levels of a protein biomarker called S100 beta. And that was the first signal that we got that the so-called blood-brain barrier, this idea of excluding blood material from the brain, so that the properties that blood vessels in the brain have is what we term the blood-brain barrier. They tightly regulate what gets into and out of the brain on a daily basis. That barrier property was breaking down in patients who had COVID-19 acutely, but also were self-reporting brain fog. So that was the first ever evidence that there was something happening at the level of blood vessels.
So your biomarker is this S100 beta protein, is that right? Are you familiar? Exactly. Was that something that we know the mechanism of or what it does in the brain beforehand?
Yeah, that's been reported before. So we certainly weren't the first people to show this, that this was a biomarker of blood-brain barrier disruption. But we were the first to show that it was associated with brain fog in COVID patients. So yeah, it's produced by a cell type in the brain called the astrocyte. The astrocyte is like a structural cell in the brain. And if there's any damage, like with a traumatic brain injury or a concussion, it'll be released into the blood, just through damage of the blood vessels. But this whole idea that maybe SARS-CoV-2 infection acutely was driving, you know, subtle changes to the blood vessels in the brain, it led us to this idea as the year developed in 2020, when long COVID started to rear its head, that myself and Colin decided to, you know, pivot our research to start asking, well, if the blood-brain barrier and the blood vessels are disrupted in acute COVID-19, what about these patients who have long COVID and are self-reporting brain fog? Maybe the brain fog that they have is because the blood vessels haven't repaired themselves. They're still leaky. So there's a technique that we use clinically in all our clinical research called dynamic contrast enhanced MRI. DCE MRI. And it sounds complicated, but it's actually very straightforward. While you're lying in a scanner, in an MRI scanner, getting a picture of your brain taken, there's a cannula placed in your hand, in a vein in your hand or in your arm, and we inject a dye that lights up the blood vessels in the brain. And this
like
dye
UV paint.
Inject, exactly. The dye that we inject has a property that it doesn't really get across the blood-brain barrier. So it'll flood into the blood vessels in the brain, and then it'll just wash out. If there's any signal left after about 20 minutes of repeated scanning, that's a sure sign that the dye has leaked out of the blood vessels and deposited in the brain and leave a little signal that will allow the MRI scanner to pick it up. And that's how we were able to show that patients who had brain fog, who had long COVID, had a leaky blood-brain barrier. The blood vessels in their brain were leaky because this dye was penetrating the blood vessels and depositing in the brain.
What about people who didn't have brain fog? Did they not show this leakage?
So the way that we designed this, and it's really important, you mentioned controls, it's really, really important to have very, very strong control groups. So the control groups in our study were patients who had COVID but made a full recovery. So their brains were absolutely normal. The next group that was a control group was patients who had long COVID but didn't report brain fog. They had no neurological symptoms at all. They had respiratory and fatigue, but they didn't actually have brain fog. And then the third cohort was the patients who had long COVID with brain fog. So none of the recovered patients and none of the patients who didn't report brain fog had any sign of blood-brain barrier disruption. It was only those patients who had brain fog.
That's a bit of a smoking gun, isn't it? That's good. That's great. So you've identified that COVID can, in some people, cause this leakage of the blood-brain barrier, and that can lead to poor cognitive function for some patients. Do we know why some people get that and some people don't? Was there anything that differentiated these patients from each other other than the fact that they had brain fog?
No, so that is, you know, a strand of research that we need to fully develop. We didn't have anything. There was no signals in our data sets that suggested why one person was more susceptible than another person. We don't know. It in all likelihood, in any work that deals with vasculature and blood vessels, we talk about this concept of a threshold that, you know, I spoke to you before, Jonathan, about some of our research on epilepsy and temporal lobe epilepsy. And it's really interesting that the human brain, every single person walking planet Earth can have a seizure. The brain can be pushed to just far enough that we can have a seizure. But your threshold to have a seizure might be much higher than my threshold. And we think that a lot of it is to do with the integrity of the blood vessels in the brain. That the integrity of your blood vessels could be 10 times more intact than mine. And it means that my brain is more primed to flip into a brain fog mode compared to yours, or yours is more resistant to stimuli like SARS-CoV-2 infection or seizure activity. So that's kind of our thinking, that it's a thresholding-based approach, that the blood vessels are primed in some patients.
Is it unusual for a virus to have this effect on the blood-brain barrier, or do we see that in other viruses?
Yeah, so SARS-CoV-2 isn't the typical what we would term a neurotrophic virus. So you'll have heard of rabies. Everyone knows what rabies is. Rabies is a classic neurotrophic virus. It loves the blood vessels in the brain, and it loves getting access to the brain. And really, in rabies, as soon as you start seeing neurological symptoms of that, it generally will lead to very high rates of mortality. We know measles has a neurotrophic effect as well. So that's why measles is so dangerous, and we need to vaccinate populations against measles, because measles virus loves the brain as well. And then we also have viruses like, you know, viral meningitis that loves to get into the meninges, which is the blood vessels kind of surrounding the brain. There are lots and lots of neurotrophic viruses. But it is a bit of a surprise that the novel coronavirus that causes COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2, has this neurotropism. But there's lots and lots of data, not just from our group, but also around the world, that it likes the brain. And we think that it gets in via the olfactory bulb. So we do think that anosmia that some patients were experiencing during the first wave was the virus gradually accessing the neural tissue of the olfactory bulb. And in some patients, why, we don't know, it was moving from the olfactory bulb back towards the higher cortical regions of the brain.
Okay, so for those listening who bells are ringing when you talk about brain fog and COVID, what can we do to help them? Having a biomarker is great and all, but unless you have some method of treating those patients, it only serves future research, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's been really interesting. It's actually been incredible for science and translational science that the public have become so vested in understanding clinical trial process and how we do it. But one of the most critical parts of a clinical trial and any developmental drugs that are being purported to work in human disease is that we have good biomarkers. Because if we don't, it's like playing darts blindfolded, you know. And we saw the mess that was made from the French group who tried to, you know, promote hydroxychloroquine for the treatment of COVID-19. They completely messed up the whole system. And it was based on very, very little proof. And part of the reason was they had no biomarker. So when they gave their patients a drug, they couldn't say, and look, this is a biomarker that's changing as well as the patients improving clinically. So that's what we lack with brain fog in general, for all conditions that have brain fog, not just COVID-19, we lack a good biomarker. And that's why I think these results that we got are so important, in that we now have a marker that can say, you have brain fog, you're self-reporting brain fog, and I can see it on an MRI scan. Because if a new drug comes along, we can then administer the drug in a very, very controlled clinical trial setting, and look to see whether the patient improves clinically. So does their self-reported brain fog improve, but does the biomarker change as well? Because if those two things are happening, it means that the drug is engaging, there's target engagement happening, and it's working the way that we think and say that it's working. That's really, really important for any novel drug and novel treatment. As scientists and also my colleagues as clinicians, they need to have a good handle on exactly how these drugs are working to make it safe, first of all, and to make sure that it's efficacious for patients.
So what next, Matt? Where do you go with this research? Because that brain fog obviously doesn't just happen with COVID. Where are you planning on taking the research?
Yeah, so one of the major strategies that we're looking at now is therapeutic development. So working with the Future Neuro Center, the SFI-funded Future Neuro Center, which has just launched its phase two, essentially, which is the second iteration of the center, we are really heavily focused on developing therapeutics for conditions such as epilepsy and ALS, but also now for long COVID and brain fog associated with long COVID. So really exciting times that's the next major focus is therapy development.
Really interesting research. And thank you so much for your time. Fantastic communicator, Matt. Dr. Matthew Campbell is from the Future Neuro Center and Trinity's School of Genetics and Microbiology. Matt, thanks for your time.
Great. Thanks, Jonathan.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.